on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 93-year-old John Decker of Merced, California, originally from Long Island, New York. He spent 28 years in the Air Force, retiring as a lieutenant colonel. But when he signed up before Pearl Harbor, it was still the U.S. Army Air Corps. He told us how he got married just 4 hours after he earned his wings. He and Ruth are still married 72 years later. We heard about his brief time spent in England with the 15th Bomb Squadron, the first American unit to bomb Europe during World War II. In fact, 50 years later, the Royal Air Force gave Mr. Decker and other surviving members of that 15th Squadron the Aircrew Europe Star for the historic joint effort of American and British crews. They even gave a medal to Ruth and two other wives who'd been married to the pilots when they flew those missions and still were married to them all those years later. But when the invasion of North Africa was happening in 1942, Mr. Decker was shipped there, and they had you flying those twin-engine A-20 Havocs on submarine patrol over the Mediterranean. What were those missions like? Were they low altitude? Were they taxing the range of those A-20s? What do you remember about those missions?
We had a definite range we could go. In other words, in 4 hours, 2 hours out, 2 hours back. And we did fly about 1,000 feet looking for any things that might suggest a submarine. We weren't too successful, but however, we did get commendation saying that we had cut down the submarine warfare about 80%, so we felt happy.
So you didn't see a lot of things to drop anything on, but just by your being out there, it was a deterrent.
That's correct, yeah. Then, of course, about a year later, I was sent back to the States on my own by C-47s, so I got to fly from Oran to Algiers, Casbah to Casablanca, Southern Africa, Gold Coast, across to Brazil, Natal, and then to Trinidad, and back to Miami.
That's a lot of hopping. You saw a good chunk of the world that way, huh?
Oh, yeah. And, of course, when I got to Miami, I had flown with a bunch of ferry pilots that were flying on a Pan Am flag boat, and we played poker, and they were better poker players than I was. So I landed in Miami. I had to wire to my father in Long Island and say, Dad, favorite son back? Need $50 to get on a railroad to get to Long Island. And he said it.
And I'm sure you paid him back. Maybe you learned a lesson there, too. I want to take you back to North Africa. You mentioned those missions patrolling for German submarines. And I imagine that was fairly monotonous, having to be alert enough. Having to be alert enough to see something and the rare occasion it actually crops up. Did you ever have any false alarms or anything?
No, it became routine because everything in North Africa was moving toward Egypt, and where we were located in Oran, there weren't any activity at all.
So you never shot at any whales or anything?
No, didn't do that at all.
And what about the life there? Because here you're a big city kid from New York. I know you said there's a lot of farmland on Long Island at the time, but being there in North Africa with these different cultures and with all these other pilots and support crew, what was that like? Did you have some memories that still stand out today?
Yes, it was one of these things, like, for example, our flight surgeon walked downtown in Oran with him, and he started pointing out different things, diseases that some of the people had, and some of them didn't have a hand. He said, well, he was probably a thief, and they cut it off, and things like that, which were kind of startling. And so we got time in Oran, which is a big city, laying there, and I started scratching. And I worked with my buddy, and he said, oh, bed bugs. He gets up and puts his clothes on. Bed bugs, never heard of them. So I got up and stayed outside, went out to the door, and there's a guard with a gun, and he's mumbling. I said, what's the problem? He said, I'm a cook. I'm not a soldier. They put me on guard duty. I'm a cook. I said, well, okay. So the next thing I know, he points his rifle at his toe. And bang, the shoe opens up and there's no toe. And boy, I don't know what to do. I called the MPs, got them taken care of. And as he goes, he says, well, I'm not going to stay here long. And he went back to the States shooting himself.
Yeah, I imagine you never see those things coming. It alters your perspective. Were there other things that you saw that were difficult to stomach, difficult to take in, realizing that this is war and people are being wounded and dying around you? Did you see much of that?
No, actually it was long range, because particularly when you're in the air, it may see the results later on. But you don't see anything. So you're isolated from actually seeing it, except one of your buddies doesn't come back. Then, of course, you really feel bad about it, but there's nothing you can do. And then you're young, bold, and ready to go.
And you said that like you did have buddies that didn't make it back from missions.
One in England on a training mission where they went through a power line and the guy was in the nose. The airplane survived, but the nose, the navigator was, he was killed. And we all went to the morgue and looked at the man laying there, and it was kind of heartbreaking.
Did you ever take that thought and extrapolate a little bit and say, you know, that could be me? I might not be coming back home?
No, I figured that I was going to make it. In fact, somebody said something about being a hero, and I had it corrected. I wasn't a hero. I was a survivor. And that's the way I felt on it. Actually, I had more ground accidents or possible killing in a car than I did in an airplane. I had two accidents when I was barely new in the service, airplanes, and survived. And from then on out, as I advanced, I got over 8,000 hours at it. The only problem I had was lost an engine or something like that, which is no problem on a four-engine airplane or a six-engine airplane like a B-47. I just look forward to it. I was going to live. I mean.
And where did that assurance come from? I've heard a lot of pilots say, well, I had a picture of my sweetheart in my jacket pocket. Did you carry a photo of Ruth around?
Oh, yes. We all carried 45 guns, and I removed the plates and put glass on them, and underneath the glass I put her picture. And I come to think of it, that was what my good luck charm.
You mentioned that there were a couple accidents early in your flying career. I bring that up just so I understand, because here you are at 93 looking like you're 75 and feeling great as you approach your 73rd anniversary here with Ruth. And I think an accident, maybe that could have changed all of that. How close a call were those?
The first one I had was the first lieutenant in the A-20. I was at Fort Benning, and I was on a night flight, my first one. Our airplane we had was a place for a pilot, a man in a nose, and a man behind you, a gunner. We didn't have those at that time, so you would fly by yourself. But every time you took off, people from Fort Benning, the Army people, would come over and ask to fly. So I had this first night flight, and people, so I picked two of them, put one on the nose and one behind me in the gunner's position, and off we went. And it flew about 2 or 3 hours, and then came back, but it was raining, and it was night. And as I landed, I put the brakes on, and the next thing I know, the airplane seemed like got a push, and the hydraulic system failed. So I figured, well, I'm too long on a runway and not enough to get off, so I'm going to have to try to ground loop it. I tried to ground loop it, and the next thing I know, a big ditch came up, which you don't see when you take off because you're busy, and into the ditch, and it split the right wing, and gas started pouring out. I called the tower. They sent the fire trucks out. The man in the nose got out. The man in the rear got out. And I started to lift the long canopy up to get out. I couldn't. And next I know there's a fireman up there with an axe chopping at it. And I had to sort of back away from it and everything else. And he opened it up. I'm feeling good. I mean, I survived. So I go the next morning to my squadron commander, explained to him what happened, everything else. And he understood, made a report out on it. And he said, oh, incidentally, you're scheduled for another night flight tonight. Which didn't bother me at all until I got out to there, and these people standing around that wanted to fly the night before, no one wanted to fly with me. And I couldn't figure it out. Well, I finally figured it out, but it kind of shook me up a little. But off I went, flew it, no problem.
I'm sure if you were listening to Mr. Decker describe ending up in that ditch, you had an image in your mind of what that scene might have looked like. And you don't have to imagine. He actually has a photo of that, and we have it up on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You'll see the A-20 with its nose in the ditch. You'll see where the right wing snapped and fuel started leaking. And you'll see that cockpit that he had to be rescued from. There are a few more photos, too. And I mentioned how you've flown so many of the aircraft models on display at Castle Air Museum. I'll name a few. The B-17, B-25, C-47. We're just scratching the surface there. But one of the reasons you flew so many different aircraft was what your duties were after you came back from North Africa. As the war went on and on, more and more air crews needed training, and they needed it quickly. We've heard a lot of veterans describe on this program how they would practice shooting targets being towed through the air by airplanes.
And I guess some of them might have been shooting at you because you were flying those planes, towing the targets for most of the rest of World War II, right?
Well, after I came back and had some duty time in the East Coast, went back at the end of the war to Germany in the occupation, spent 3 years in Wiesbaden, Germany, and I was on the Inspector General's inspection team, for which we had bases in Italy, Austria, and Germany, and spent 3 years doing that, and then finally assigned to the air refueling squadron, the first one in SAC, and became an air refueler. As we said, we used to pass gas.
Passed a lot of gas at high altitudes. And SAC, for those who don't recognize that acronym, that's Strategic Air Command. And for many years, that's what Castle Air Force Base here in Atwater was the center of. And of course, the base is no longer open. The museum is here, and so many of those great aircraft are preserved. In fact, one of those that you have a chance to climb aboard and explore is the KC-135. You're wearing the hat. You spent a lot of time in those, and I want to get to that. But let me backtrack a little bit. I think some folks, since this show focuses so often on World War II, and we hear about a lot of the guys who came through the ranks and were trained here and there and everywhere, and they talk about as aerial gunners having to shoot at sleeves being towed by other airplanes. You spent a lot of time as a pilot towing targets stateside the rest of World War II?
Yes, that's correct. So it was towing targets for any aircraft, both where they'd fire at us and also for just tracking for the guns on the ground, also for fighters. In fact, we were assigned to Walterboro, South Carolina, and we were towing targets for a fighter group of Tuskegee, the Black Fire Pilots, and we did that for about a year until they moved on and we moved on to back overseas.
So as you're flying all these targets, maybe this sounds like a dumb question to you, but I'm sure a lot of people out there are wondering, were you ever concerned that some of these rookie pilots or aerial gunners might be a little trigger happy or a little inaccurate and might give you some trouble?
Well, one of the things was if you're up in the front, you don't see what's going on behind you. Example, we got B-17s for tow targets, and then I'd go back in the tail and look. And of course, we were towing for fighter pilots at the time, and you could see them coming in and swerving right toward you. It looks like got your tail before they start firing, and then they pull away. So it made it just kind of a, I think I'll go back up in the front and stay where I'm supposed to be. But other than that, and same thing, the anti-aircraft, when they fired at you, the shell exploded in front of you. It went past the target. But it really didn't cling. We did have some instances where the airplanes were hit. B-34s, a twin-engine bomber type that we were towing with, and they did get some shells or hits in the bottom of the airplane, but nothing serious, so we just accepted. The only time I did have one problem was we also did night flying for searchlights where they tracked us and everything else, and I was flying with a WASP a co-pilot, and so she was flying along, it was night, and I looked down and looked into the searchlight, hit me, and for a minute I was sort of blinded, and everything else started to go back and forth, and I looked at the airplane and righted it out and started to find a way. And the WASP looked at me, she says, "What the hell were you doing?" So she didn't know, I didn't explain it to her. And other than that, the rest of it was kind of you just expected to do what you're supposed to do and then didn't have any troubles.
It appears that that gave you the opportunity to fly a wide variety of aircraft, that you got to experiment. Was that fun for you to feel out all these different aircraft, or was that a little nerve-wracking because it was unfamiliar?
Well, the only problem we had in the beginning was that the training program in the individual organizations was different. And like when I got into the first tow target outfit, I arrived, and the next day I ran to a pilot saying, "He's going to Memphis. Would you like a ride?" So I said, "Certainly." Well, he's flying a B-34, which was a twin-engine bomber, and I flew as co-pilot. We landed at Memphis, spent the day, night, came back the next day, and he said, "Would you like to land?" Well, I'm just new at the base. I said, "Sure, I'd like to land." So I landed it, and the next morning, I come down to operations. They said, "You're scheduled to fly a tow target mission today for the anti-aircraft." I said, "Well, I'm not checked out or anything." "Oh, yes, you are. The captain said he checked you out yesterday." He did? Yeah. So then he said, "Well, you have to have a test of 25 questions, which is easy to make out." So I made it out, set me out to the airplane, and I said, I didn't watch him start it. But anyway, he didn't have a co-pilot, but he had a crew chief, and he knew how to start it. So, in fact, he even wanted to fly it when I got in the air. So I took off, no problem. And that's the way a lot of those airplanes rise in those 25 different airplanes that they had at the base. Somebody take me out to the airplane and say, here's the throttle, there's this. And I say, you going to ride with me? Oh, no, I got something else I got to do. So off I go on my own. And in those days, young kids, boy, we didn't have any problem. But my career on flying airplanes, a lot of times I flew an airplane at minimum checkout. In other words, they had to have somebody fly this to there. Off you go. And you made it. Come back.
Well, what about today? I mean, you're only 93. You're in pretty good shape. If one of those planes out here on the field at Castle Air Museum was fly ready and they fired it up for you, would you take it down the runway and see what you could do?
I think I could do it. I mean, I still have some of that go, go, go that I had when I was young that I can remember because I was real strict in how we did it. We had checklists and everything else, and I had a co-pilot would check everything else, make sure we were ready to go. Here we went. I didn't expect to have any trouble.
That's the way it was. John Decker, 93 years old. I know he doesn't sound like he's that old. When we come back, we're going to explore some of his adventures during the Cold War from the Berlin airlift and beyond. When Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
EECU reminds us of the importance of honoring our greatest generation.
Hi, I'm Paul Leffler, and there's nothing I enjoy more than honoring our hometown heroes from the greatest generation. That's why I'm so excited that Honor Flight, a nonprofit organization that flies World War II veterans to their memorial in Washington, D.C., is closing in on a very successful first year. And if that wasn't exciting enough, I'm thrilled to tell you that my friends at EECU are once again raising money to help the next round of vets make that journey.
Hurry in to EECU during the month of March to get financing as low as 2.2% APR on new and used autos. And EECU will donate $50 to Central Valley Honor Flight for every qualifying auto loan over $10,000.
In World War II, all gave some and some gave all. Let's come together and help give our veterans one more tour. With honor.
EECU. Smarter banking since 1934.
Rates subject to change. Some restrictions apply. Federally insured by NCUA.